This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. A warning to listeners, this episode includes discussion of sex. I know I'm a little bit late to the game here, but I just got so deep into the TV show Love on the Spectrum.
Hi, I'm Tanner. What's your name?
Kate.
It's nice to meet you, Kate.
Love on the Spectrum follows several lovebirds as they navigate the world of dating.
I don't think we're compatible.
And I adore the participants on the show, all of whom are on the autism spectrum. In a world full of reality TV villains and villainesses, it's been really fun to watch a group of charismatic and caring individuals who are honestly looking for love.
My name is Kaylin. I'm 24 years old, and I'm single, and I'm looking for a boyfriend.
Why do you want to find love?
I don't want to die alone.
And amid all the dates, there is one person who seems to connect with everyone, relationship coach Jennifer Cook.
Hello, are you Tanner?
Yes, ma'am, I'm Tanner.
It's nice to meet you, I'm Jennifer.
It's nice to meet you, Jennifer.
As the participants swim through the dating pool, they have check-ins and advice calls with Jennifer, who brings her own experience as someone with autism into the fold.
So many folks don't feel good in their own skin. They may be in the middle of the crowd, but they feel lonely, disconnected, not seen. And I think that teasing these truths apart ends up making everybody feel connected because we all relate.
This week, we're getting all up in the mind of the show's relationship coach to understand how her unique approach to dating on the spectrum has lessons for us all. Jennifer, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here with you.
I'm so excited to have you here. To get started, what has it been like for you to work with people who are also on the spectrum and see them learn things from you or even through the show, master some of the skills that you've taught them, but also skills that you really had to work hard to master?
I cheer like a nerd. It's great. You know, everybody loves Tanner. He's an absolute sweetheart. When I told him that if he didn't know what else to say, he could say, I don't know what else to say, but I'm having a really good time.
Okay. Hey, Kate, I can't think of anything else to say, but I'm having a really good time.
And then he actually uses that on his date verbatim. Yeah. I was cheering like a madwoman. So, you know, it's so exciting. Yes, because, you know, you're on their side and you want people to be genuinely happy and you want things to go well. And when it does, you know, that's good stuff.
Oh, it is good stuff. To that point, I love the way you teach people about flow of conversation. You outline how when you go on a date, you want to talk about things that you care about and you want to ask your date questions. But the person you're on a date with, they feel the same way. You have to leave space for the other person to get to their interests and their curiosities.
That's right.
And I love how you coach people to ask their dates questions. It's not something that I was necessarily taught.
And that's the thing. I think that curiosity in a relationship is a beautiful thing. For the most part, folks feel like that the definition of being charismatic, right, is showing up and being the one that's in the center of the room because you are all that. Real charisma, I think, is when you can make everyone else around you feel good about themselves genuinely and show that you're genuinely interested in them because then everybody wants to be around you more. Right?
That's the real Riz. Everyone's talking about Riz. You got the real Riz.
I try. Curiosity is a beautiful thing in a relationship. And if you can bring that in and say, like, I am so stoked to get to know you because we're not the same. Like, can you please like enrich my life? Mm. That's good stuff. Like, that's yay.
Hmm. My parents are high school sweethearts. And so I wasn't necessarily taught how to date.
I don't think many of us are.
Yeah, really. I mean, I have a question about that. Like, why should all of us, autistic and allistic people, think about dating as a skill that should be practiced and can be learned?
Yes, first of all, you said it beautifully. And why? Because I think that if we're critiqued on something, we take that critique as a critique of ourselves instead of a behavior or an action that we've taken or a choice that we've made. We're personalizing it, internalizing it. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same thing when it comes to dating. And I think that's why it can feel so devastating, right? Or sometimes artificially inflating as well, right? Mm. So if by the same token, we can just view them as skills that can be tweaked or turned or unlearned or learned or improved upon, then our authentic selves remain true and steady and not at fault at any point.
Hmm. I was really struck by how you helped some of the participants on the show realize new possibilities for themselves through talking with you. Aww. Like, for example, Tanner, breaking him out of the idea that he always has to bring people joy and be positive all the time, you gently let him know that he doesn't have to be happy all of the time, and people will still like him.
People will like you. Uh-huh. Even if you get sad sometimes, people will still like you. I want you to hear that. It's okay. You don't have to talk all the time. You don't have to laugh and smile all the time. People will just think you're being quiet.
Okay.
And I remember like seeing his expression change, you know, like it seemed to totally change his world around. Yeah. How do you help people change the narratives they believe about themselves? And why was that important to do before they started dating?
Talking about Tanner and talking about that idea that he maybe felt pressure to always be on. I've seen that before. I've been that before. You know, my other nickname in high school besides the flirt was Happy Head. I was very peppy. And for me, peppy meant safety. You know, people were going to want to be around up. I think in recognizing, I saw there was something in Tanner's eyes that just looked familiar. And there was a young lady that I was coaching just like the other week. And she said, you know, the same thing. She was very, very, very up and talking about how she was proud of this and this, that, and the other thing, and kind of going, and the speech was rapid. And then she sort of stopped for just a half a moment to look at me to judge me. Was everything okay? And I think we do that. We check in and take the temperature a lot as autistic people because it hasn't always been safe. We have been off or misread situations so many times. And I said to her, you do know that you don't have to be, right? You can turn it down and you're going to be safe and loved. And she started bawling.
Dating is something almost everybody gets anxious about, and everyone is different. But do you have some like tried and true concrete advice for people who struggle with dating?
First of all, there are the trick things to say, which are if you want somebody to say more, ask them, tell me more about that.
I didn't learn that until I started interviewing for work. Like, I'm sure. Professional, and someone had to teach me like, oh, this is a thing that you can say. And I was like, and now I use it in real life all the time.
And people love it because they want to tell you more about that. But really what it comes down to is you have to be able to be friends first. The lover element is fabulous and important and the chemistry's got to be there.
Wow. Love on the Spectrum is an edited show, highly edited show. It can't represent every experience of people on the spectrum.
Absolutely.
What do you think is missing from the show that could paint a fuller picture of life on the spectrum?
That's a great question. I think they did something important in season two that I definitely felt was missing before. And it's a couple things. I thought it was really, really, really great that in season two, that first of all, we had more people of color, that we had queer representation. That was important, right? Because, and then the topic that I thought was really important, that I was super glad that came up, was when they let Danny talk with me about sex and not just love.
There's one most important subject that I would like to talk about is how to have a successful, intimate relationship. I really want a serious, intimate relationship that would guarantee me that we can live together.
So often, people in the disability communities, and I really genuinely like to think of ASD, autism spectrum disorder, as autism spectrum dynamic, because I think that the disability isn't autism itself. It's kind of the way the world fits against it. But it's very common to infantilize those with varying disabilities. And and so then it can be very condescending. What I loved was not only the fact that we got to have a conversation about sex, but that it was women having a conversation about sex. I thought that was really, really awesome. So that was a biggie to me. That was something really important to get tapped into.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking with me today. This has been great.
Thank you. Oh, it's been my absolute pleasure. Really enjoy.
That was relationship coach Jennifer Cook. Coming up, we get into some criticism of Love on the Spectrum.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
A warning to listeners, this next segment includes discussion of sex. Like many viewers, I fell in love with the participants on Love on the Spectrum. Anybody who's ever been in love would connect with Abby and David sharing a sweet moment about what they like about each other on vacation on the Kenyan Plains. But as someone who isn't autistic, I wondered what autistic viewers thought of the show. And so I put out a little messenger birdie. And host of the podcast Gender Reveal and friend of the show Tuck Woodstock responded. He and podcast producer Morgan Givens have both watched the entire series, and they had some thoughts that added a lot of perspective to how I view the show's framing. I still appreciate Jennifer and all the participants of the show, but the show itself has a long way to go, according to these two viewers. Morgan, welcome to It's Been a Minute, and Tuck, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. We are here to talk about Love on the Spectrum. I want to hear from each of you. What do you think this show was perhaps trying to accomplish?
So the thing that I think they would perhaps claim to be doing is humanizing autistic people for a general audience. Because I've been in meetings with reality show execs. They're really interested in making shows for the mainstream consumer. They're thinking about ways that non-autistic people will feel good in their hearts having watched autistic people try to find love. So if the argument is that they are trying to humanize autistic people, I would argue that reality TV and dating reality TV is an inherently dehumanizing platform. We know how it works. Everyone becomes a one-dimensional character because there's only so much time to be introduced to so many people, and we want to make them into convenient narratives. So you cannot humanize people in all their complexities in a dating show where you're also packing many, many people on this season of this show.
You're saying there's not even enough time to spend with each person to build out any of their dimensions?
No, absolutely not. And then the other thing that they're clearly doing in the editing, and to cite my bona fides for a second, I have a documentary editing background. Something that they're clearly doing in the editing, especially in the US version, which is what we're mostly talking about, is upplaying awkwardness of the dates for jokes. If you film anyone's first date and your first date is with someone who you've never met, you don't know what to expect, and there's a crew filming you, that's going to be awkward. Inherently, I can edit any date to be awkward. It is very easy to do. You can use editing tricks. You can use music tricks. Anything can look awkward.
I agree with a lot of Tuck's points, especially when he's talking about how they're talking about, oh, we're doing this to humanize autistic people. But that presupposes that there is something inhumane about our existence in the first place. And that is not true. Like, the problem is y'all don't see us as full people, not that we don't recognize the fullness of our existence.
When we think about reality shows, mostly they have a hook of some kind. So Love is Blind, the hook is you don't see each other. Married at First Sight, the hook is you get married at first sight, right? The hook for Love on the Spectrum is just they're autistic. And I think that it's dehumanizing to treat they're autistic in the same way as we might treat they're getting engaged behind a wall.
So you both think the show is ineffective at humanizing people on the spectrum. I wonder, in what ways do you think the show reinforces harmful stereotypes?
A lot of the dates with two autistic people, I do think, can be hampered by all of the advice they're getting from mostly family members of ways that they should date neurotypically.
Like our inability to connect if we don't look people in the eye, which is absurd to me.
My favorite moments on the show are when two autistic people just get to hang out for an extended period of time and everyone else gets out of their way, because that's when we see ways that autistic people interact with each other in ways that are so beautiful because they're not being narrated. For example, Abby and David just hanging out with each other, talking about lions, and the way that they interact are so beautiful because they really get each other. Or there's a moment in the Australian series that I really like where it's two autistic people on a date and one of them asks, oh, hey, how do you handle making eye contact? Because it's really hard for me. And the other one is like, oh, here are some tips that I learned from my therapist. But that said, I will never expect you to make eye contact with me if you don't want to. Like, that's totally fine. I don't care. It's hard for me too. And that gives the first person enough feeling of safety and trust to make brief eye contact with her. And that is such a cool moment to see, because I know how much that means as an autistic person that he was able to do that. And I know how good it feels to me when I am told that it is okay if I'm not looking at someone, because that gives me the safety to do it if I want to and do it on my own terms. And I hate to reduce autism to just eye contact because there are so many layers, but I think that stuff like that is really easy to point to.
Okay, to go back to the parents for a minute, watching the show, the way it focuses on the parents, like their anxieties, their fears about their kids being alone or, you know, quote unquote, never finding love, like at times the parents' nervousness felt more palpable than the participants. How do you think like that parental point of view affects the framing of the show?
I mean, I think it affects the framing of the show because I think it affects the folks covered in the show. Like, I think in season one, when Abby is sitting with Jennifer and Jennifer's like, yeah, you know, I'm autistic too. I'm married. I got kids. Abby is stunned.
So Abby, you want to know something?
Yeah.
I'm on the spectrum too. I have autism too. And all three of my kids do too.
But how could you have kids if you're on the spectrum?
You can do anything you want to.
It's up to the individual person.
It has nothing to do with autism.
Exactly.
Exactly right.
She is flummoxed.
Yes.
Her flapper has been gasted because she does not understand. Like, the fact that this was something she did not even realize was attainable for her puts that a little more into context. Like, what did you grow up in? And where could you be if you were not in an environment that treated you as though these were things that were unattainable for you? Because clearly, You're capable.
And multiple parents have just been like, it's so amazing that my child, an adult, is going on one date because I never imagined this is possible for them. And I'm like, that's a really horrifically limiting understanding of what you expected for your child. You know, if we're talking about this show as, you know, maybe trying to bust some autism myths or stereotypes, they're really following so many stereotypes. We're seeing, you know, mostly white people, almost entirely straight people for some reason, entirely, as far as we know, cisgender people, which is absolutely bananas.
Which is wild.
Say more about why that's bananas.
Many, many autistic people are trans. Many, many, many trans people are autistic. As a gender expert, if I meet a trans person, I assume they're autistic unless they tell me otherwise. Like, that is how big the overlap is. And it sucks that even just saying that to you, I am aware that the fact that so many trans people are autistic is used as a way to gatekeep trans people from accessing care, because there are a lot of trans people who are not allowed to access transition care because they are autistic. But regardless, there are so many autistic trans people. It is so wild that they're not on the show. Autistic people are more likely to reject societal norms that don't make sense to them. And so that's why so many of us are queer and trans. And so it's weird that that's not showing up more than it is on the show. And then we're also, you know, disproportionately seeing adults who live with parents or guardians. We're also disproportionately seeing, you know, autistic people who have never dated, never kissed, never had sex. And that's fine. I understand that that's a focus of the show.
It's a lot of virgins on the show.
But there are autistic people who are married, autistic people who have five girlfriends, autistic sex workers. Fern Brady wrote a great book that talks about her being an autistic stripper who has a ton of boyfriends and girlfriends. These are all normal things for autistic people to experience. And I just think that if they are going in to like bust some myths and stereotypes, why is there no acknowledge that many autistic people are out here dating successfully, having sex, knowing how sex works? You know, like I enjoyed seeing, for example, like Danny check out six books on sex and make her, you know, family uncomfortable with them, which by the way, they should not be uncomfortable with a grown woman learning about sex.
She's grown.
Like that was fun to see. But like, if that's the only representation you're seeing is a lot of people being shy about holding hands for the first time, which is cute. People are going to get the idea that all autistic people have ever done is hold hands and read a book about sex. And that's just not true in many circumstances. So we're just not seeing a range of other realities for people for whom this is their introduction to what autism looks like.
You know, I keep thinking about the criticism that the show is teaching masking. And for those of you who don't know, in the realm of autism, masking is when an autistic person changes their natural behavior to conform to social pressures. And I'm curious, what would a neurodivergent approach to dating look like to you? Like, how could that be achieved more authentically in your eyes?
I mean, for me, I think about leaning more into the honesty of what you want to say and speaking exactly what you mean. Because a lot of folks that I know who are neurotypical or autistic, it feels like they speak in code. And I'm like, why don't you just say what you mean? Why do I have to decipher this?
Building off what Morgan said, I think like honesty and also direct communication, and something that I also love in the show is how often people will ask, do you want to hold hands? Would you like to kiss? Would you be interested in sex before marriage? And I would like to see more open communication about what people want from each other, instead of just feeling like you have to guess or make a move or wait. So if we could just get used to like being normal when someone communicates with us directly, we might be more comfortable with also like directly stating our wants and needs. That's a really vulnerable thing to do, but I think the people on this show do it really, really well. And I hate that it's played for laughs so often, because it's a really cool skill that we could all be doing.
Yep.
Tuck, Morgan, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me about this today.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. It's a dream. It was fun.
That was host of the Gender Reveal podcast, Tuck Woodstock, and Flyest Fables producer, Morgan Givens.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hi, this is Sophie. Taylor Swift just dropped her new album, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Sophie, thank you so much for calling in with this question about Taylor Swift's new album, The Tortured Poets Department. So this album came out last weekend. Lord have mercy, is it a humdinger? Now, I'll say this. The album itself originally was only supposed to be 16 tracks. But then on the same day that she released the album, she said, I'm going to release another 15 songs. And call that the Tortured Poets Department, the anthology. So the day this album dropped, she actually released 31 songs. I don't think I would listen to 31 songs from anybody, truthfully, at this point in my life. Editing is okay. It's okay to kind of pare down what you want to talk about so that people can walk away with some sort of takeaway. Now, as I've said on the show before, I think that Taylor Swift is somebody who has talent. And her first three albums, actually, I was a pretty big fan of. All that being said, at this point, Taylor Swift ain't but 2 years younger than I am. I'm 36 years old and Taylor Swift is 34. But only one of us is consistently talking about boys as if she's in like eighth grade language arts class. She went through a couple of breakups and it wasn't fun, which I'll say a lot of pop music is built on that idea, and that's okay. But then I had to deal with the melodies, the music, the instrumentation. I wasn't feeling it. I have realized recently that I am perhaps in the minority of people who does not like Taylor Swift's work with her longtime producing partner, Jack Antonoff. It sounds like somebody who's going for a big anthemic sound and just missing. And I don't understand. I know that those are some of her more popular albums. I know that's what the fans are loving. And maybe that's what she decided to do with this album. But for me, I just think that the kind of themes that she's continuing to circle, the sound that she's not progressing out of, all signs to me are pointing to maybe it's just time for Taylor to take a break. Go on vacation. Learn a new language. Take some cooking classes. Spend time with that hunky boyfriend of hers. That's what I would do if I had that much money. So Taylor, I don't know. I mean, she's not listening to this, but on the off chance, I just want to let you know it's okay to take a break. Sophie, thank you so much for calling in with this question. I really appreciate it. If you want to be heard on an upcoming Hey Brittany, I have a question for you. The Met Gala is around the corner, and I want to know, what's been your favorite Met Gala theme and why? Send us a voice memo at ibam@npr.org. That's ibam@npr.org. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Jessica Plachek.
Engineering support came from
Stacey Abbott.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Get the service you deserve. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Osea. This Mother's Day, treat mom to Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.